Welcome to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast.
Hello, and welcome to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. My name is Rob Farley, and today with me is Cheryl Rofer, and we are going to talk about Russia and the Russia-Ukraine war. How are you doing today?
Fine. Looking forward to it. There's a lot going on.
Oh, yeah, there is a great deal going on. So you've been reading and you've been writing, and I know you've been thinking a lot about what we could describe as the way that Russia's goals in this war, despite the fact that their ability to accomplish the goals seems to be getting more and more sharply curtailed every day, their discussion of goals is becoming more maximalist. So could we start off by just having a conversation about what it's sounding like Russia is wanting out of this war at this point?
Boy, that is really hard because Putin has said a number of things that might lead one to believe that what he would like to do is reconstitute the Soviet Union or more likely the Russian Empire, or at least bring together all the Russias, as in Tsar of all the Russias, which would be Great Russia, Little Russia, which is Ukraine, and White Russia, which is Belarus. And there's certainly action in that direction. On the other hand, while some of the things Putin has said are pretty maximalist, they are, in fact, on the battlefield, pulling back from any kind of maximalist goals for the military action. It's looking more like they might be satisfied with a small bite of the eastern part of Ukraine and finally pulling off the Donbas into who knows what, an independent entity, part of Russia. It's not clear anybody knows what that would be. So there's a real conflict there, and I don't know what it means. It certainly means that Putin and the military are having some interesting conversations.
Right. And I mean, to my understanding, we're also seeing from Russian media, major Russian media figures, not really offering any sort of middle ground on this. And it's tough because what I know about Russian media comes to me through Twitter, right? And so I know that there are a lot of people on Twitter who basically just want to amplify sort of the nastiest statements that are coming out of Russia and not really talk about anything that's a little bit more moderate. But I mean, it does seem as if Russian rhetoric is not being finely tuned to match Russia's battlefield performance thus far. And it's interesting, too, the latest assessment, I think it was DOD this morning, sort of talked about what the situation on the ground is. And the progress really is incremental in a lot of places in the Donbas, right? Heavy artillery bombardment, followed up by sort of very slow, painstaking advance of infantry and armor, still taking substantial casualties. These are, you know, heavily fortified positions that they're biting into. But, you know, they're still talking in terms of Hail Marys. And that's just quite strange to me. And it strikes me that it's dangerous from a Russian civil military perspective as well.
Yeah, I wasn't adding in the Russian media into what I said earlier. And when you add in the Russian media, things really get crazy. And although, like you, my only understanding is through Twitter, so I just don't say too much about this, but they were showing pictures of how Kaliningrad could nuke Berlin in 100 seconds or something like that this morning. That's pretty inflammatory. And I think part of what we're seeing is a push to get Putin to declare a full mobilization. I think that the military, you know, if we think back to our special operations, quote unquote, the military were frequently unhappy with being limited in that way and would like a little more. And what Putin is doing is a special operation kind of thing, which means it's limited as far as the what the military can do. And the military would probably really like a full mobilization. Now, I'm not sure that dragging up a bunch of conscripts who are going to be not happy to go is going to help them a whole lot. There is some speculation that Putin will declare full mobilization on May 9th. But I think that part of the agitation we're seeing is a push to get Putin to declare full mobilization.
Right. No, I've heard the same thing, and it's interesting. I saw what was a pretty good analysis, which is, say that Putin goes ahead and declares his full mobilization in early May, and maybe it's May 9th. I think we're assigning a lot of symbolic importance to May 9th at this point, but it is a bit awkward to be having a Victory Day parade when you're in the middle of a war that you're not actually winning. And so I can see the awkwardness about that, but. The analysis is that, you can't really start funneling reservists and new conscripts into this operation in a framework of months, right? Or unless it's like 8 or 9 months, right, down the line. And so you're seeing new fresh troops being integrated into the force, basically as we're turning to 2023. And until then, Russia is sort of really in a pretty precarious military position because Ukraine's material position is improving steadily. Ukraine does not have a manpower issue because it has fully mobilized its reserves and it's fighting on its own territory. The indication, I mean, it's a really sort of fascinating thing, right? Because you announce this mobilization, you're really tipping your hand to the Ukrainians that you're gonna see this thing to the finish, which then I think would change Ukrainian behavior in interesting ways, right? It might make the Ukrainians a little bit more risk accepted in terms of pushing Russia out. So I don't really know how that plays out though, but it's an interesting gambit with really the future of the Russian state that Putin is playing with here.
Yeah, really. Putin has gotten himself into a really, really bad situation, and he doesn't have a lot of good options to carry forth on. Like you say, the Ukrainians are going to do what they can to push the Russians out. And I've been trying to think of what would be a satisfactory end game for either side. Clearly, neither side is ready to negotiate now. The Ukrainians want their country whole and under their control. And Putin has absolutely nothing to point to as a victory, although, you can kind of make up anything and say, well, this is our glorious victory and save some face that way. Although it's pretty hard to do right now. So maybe he could say something like, we have a glorious victory in that our brother country will now not be bombarding our depots. I don't know how to do it. Putin may have some ideas, and he's certainly not averse to stretching the truth. But this is where we go back to what we started with, is what are his objectives, and what less than that would be acceptable to him?
So what do you make of the rumor that he is taking direct supervision of the war at this point? And we should say this is a rumor that has emerged this morning. And so we don't quite know what to make of it. There's lots of rumors coming out of this war. But, sort of in terms of thinking about how he is approaching this from these maximalist goals, and yet the military is not, what does this tell us about? What do you think this tells us about what he thinks of the military performance so far?
Well, there was a certain amount on Twitter this morning of this has some real Steiner energy to it, and references to downfall. And if there were not copyright issues there, I think we would be seeing a river of downfall memes on Twitter. So maybe it's a good thing we're not. But historically, for the top guy to take control of the military plans has never been all that successful. So it looks like a move of desperation, if indeed the rumors are true. Although early on, I saw a comment when they had the forces all around Ukraine and they were attacking from numerous points, somebody commented that it looked like a civic war rather than a military war, because it was a bunch of little trying to infiltrate kinds of moves rather than a big push for any particular objective. And Putin is a Silovik, so he probably doesn't think like the military does. So I'm just guessing there's big differences between the military. The military also can see what's on the ground. You know, if we go to the downfall scene, you know, here's Hitler looking at the map and Steiner, we're going to do this next. And poor old Steiner is like, he knows what's on the ground. And you know, Putin has been somewhat disconnected from lots of realities, and he probably still is.
Yeah, I mean, I what I am looking forward to, and there's probably going to be maybe 10 books, but you know, I want to buy the best one that's going to be, you know, going to come out 5 years from now. It's going to have Zelensky and Putin on the cover, and it's going to be titled A Comparative Study of Civilian Leadership in the Russo-Ukrainian War, right? And to be honest, I mean, we know very little about what's going on the other side in terms of, other than to say that almost no one seems to think that Zelensky has anything in terms of like a significant decision-making role beyond being sort of the arbiter, but he doesn't have any sort of operational, doesn't apparently aspire to any operational control over Ukrainian forces, where things look much different on, or are starting to look much different on the Putin side. So I don't know, it's going to be fascinating.
Yeah. Oh, there are going to be books and books and books coming out about this in many aspects. And there are things now that we can't even guess at that we will say, well, there's going to be a book on that. I mean, I'm still kind of boggling at the incompetence of the performance of the Russian army. And they're not getting better. For a while, I could say, well, you know, maybe they didn't take control of the air in the first 2 days, but they'll come around. And man, they are not coming around. And I've been reading history. I've been reading the period from about 1896 to 1917. I've been reading the fall of the Soviet Union in 1987, 1991-ish. And Stephen Kotkin said something that I think is very insightful and is useful to keep in mind when we think about what Russia is and isn't doing. And that is that Russia aspires to be a great power. And I am paraphrasing here, but trying to get the essence of it. Russia aspires to be a great power, but it simply does not have the resources to be the kind of great power it wants to be. And you can see that politically. It does not have the economy. It does not have the development of its people to be producing in that economy. And in the military, you know, we're going to go in 3 days and we'll have a victory parade in Kyiv and everything will be cool. And
And there were, you know, if you really looked at it ahead of time and you looked at the number of military personnel around Ukraine, if you looked at the equipment they had there, it was a long shot to begin with. And so, you know, but they were going to take all of Ukraine in 3 days. So what Kotkin said there, just Russia keeps doing it over and over again. You can see it in the early 1900s. You can see it in Gorbachev's plans in the 1980s, and they don't learn.
Yeah, it's really interesting. You know, I wrote a little bit about sort of the stories that we're telling ourselves about this war and the analogies that we're borrowing. And, you know, the Russians, I mean, the Finland analogy is a very interesting one, right? Sort of retelling this war as the 1940 Winter War, right? Because on the one hand, it's attractive to the West because look what this small country managed to humiliate Russia. But on the other hand, it's also it's not exactly attractive, but it's intelligible from a Russian point of view because Russia picked itself up and won the war, right? You know, there are lots of differences, but Russia did pick itself up and win the war and did learn. And the another story here is the Kerensky Offensive, right, which is, I think, the one that the Ukrainians would really like, which is, you know, the story of a Russian army simply collapsing, right? The Russian, the provisional government. And that's also a story that people should remember when they're talking about the glory of Russian military history, is that, like, the entire army did collapse once in the middle of a war, right? So that kind of thing happens. You know, I mean, I guess one more point on this, in reading about that, I was struck, but it shouldn't have been all that striking to me. I mean, the Ukrainians really have adopted a lot of Russian and Soviet sort of military history as their own. Right, that they themselves take credit for, you know, because from their point of view, they won World War II as well, right? You know, and some Ukrainians, there was a small residue of Ukrainians that fought on the side of the Nazis. A lot more Ukrainians fought against the Nazis and fought with Red Army forces, right? And so they understand Mariupol as being like Stalingrad, right, and are not shy about appropriating that kind of Soviet military success for their own. The latest DoD report this morning did suggest that Russian casualty totals were starting to go down, that they were doing a little bit more in the Donbass to play to their strengths, which is find Ukrainians, blast them with heavy artillery, and then send forces to mop them up. You know, who knows how long that model can really be chased down. I mean, at this point, what are your concerns? I know we've talked about this before, but what are your concerns about escalation? The ways that Russia might escalate, or the ways that this war might get escalated, to use the passive voice?
Well, I think Joe Biden has been doing an amazing job with what I've been calling his information offensive. And he has put Russia on the back foot from even before when the war started. If we're looking at anniversaries, the anniversary of Russia's takeover of Crimea, I can't remember the exact date, but it was within the time when this latest offensive started. And it was conceivable that that would have been the victory parades through Kyiv when the three-day war was over. So I think Putin puts some stock on those anniversaries, but I also think that with the Biden administration saying, okay, we have intelligence and putting the information out in a really credible way that they really did have intelligence, that Russia is going to do X, Y, Z, that they're going to do a false flag as a, quote, provocation, unquote. And I think that that really wrong-footed the Russians. And I think it blew their schedules for what they were going to do. I think it pushed them into the mud season. which they had a problem with, despite some of the commentary. And I think that now Biden, with his continuing statements that the United States will not fight on the ground in Ukraine, has said, okay, Russia, if you want to escalate, it is up to you. You take full responsibility for it. You will be the bad guys. You want to escalate? Go ahead, be the bad guys. And I think that is giving Putin some heartburn too, because he would like to be seen as the savior of all the Russias, and if he's the bad guy escalating. Now, there's been a lot of talk about nuclear the past few days, and to be honest, I don't fully know what to make of that, because the Russians do like to rattle their nuclear arsenal, and it's something they've always done. The media people in Russia have been even worse about it than Putin. Putin likes to every once in a while just toss in a reference. Saying it too often kind of cheapens it, and people start not believing him, which is actually a danger on our side. People have to continue to believe him. And I think we have a really good intelligence apparatus that has a better idea than I do of what Putin may be thinking and what he may be doing. There was a little bit on Twitter yesterday or the day before about some signs of mobilizing the population, getting shelters ready in Moscow and that kind of thing. And again, it's not clear whether that is because they are going to up the nuclear ante or whether it has to do with this desire of the military to go on full mobilization.
Right. I mean, I guess, yeah, I mean, my thoughts are about the nuclear issue. You know, it goes back to this question, right, where we have to see this as a full tapestry, right? I mean, part of the tapestry here is, you know, again, the maximalist aims that Putin has been discussing, the pressures from within the state and within Russian society that at this point still actually seem escalatory rather than de-escalatory, right? You know, we're not seeing what a lot of people had hoped for, which is, you know, massive protests in Red Square against the war, right? That's still maybe to come, but you know, at this point, you know, we have to take seriously the fact that it might actually be hard for Putin to end this war, you know, given the sort of how he has started this bus down this hill. And so, you know, at this point, I suppose I would probably put some kind of conventional attack against some key installation in a NATO country as higher than the use of a nuclear weapon. But both of those would be just astonishingly dangerous, and I don't even want to think about either of them. What do you make of the Secretary of Defense's comments about part of this? I mean, his comments were, you know, part of our point now is to weaken Russia. And this, you know, spurred just a ton of commentary out there, some from the, and from, I know we talked about on the blog this morning, Scott did, from the anti-Russia left, about how, you know, really this was about hurting Russia from the beginning. What do you make of those comments? And sort of more broadly, what do you think of the idea that a major American foreign policy goal now should be to weaken the Russian state and the Russian military?
Well, I think that Austin's comment was part of the Biden information offensive, in that, you know, Biden has kind of called it the way it is a few times and gotten the same kind of uproar. And I think that Austin, I mean, of course, part of the objective is to weaken Russia. that is obvious to anybody with eyes to see. And in fact, it is working out. He's lost 15,000, 20,000 military people. I don't know how many hundred vehicles. Yeah, they're getting weakened. Economically, there was a report that because of the sanctions, one of their tank plants could no longer produce tanks. There's a RUSI report out that details some of the electronics that the Russians have been using that all come from America in their war electronics. And so, yeah, we're weakening Russia. Russia knows that. We know that. And certainly when I look at a long-term kind of perspective, it's like it sure would be nice if we could put Russia in a position where they don't do this kind of shit anymore. I mean, invading your neighbors is a bad idea for all sorts of reasons, and it's bad for the world. And now it would be nice if we could have a time machine and go back and make everything go nicely during the 90s and have Russia join NATO and have us all happy together in a Northern Hemisphere circling alliance. That didn't happen in the 1990s for many reasons. And if Dan were here, we could go into that in enormous detail. And it's not going to happen now. It's not going to happen for a long time. So it's what I think of as the if Russia were only a normal country problem, which I've discussed with, I've heard Estonian friends put it this way. And, you know, people are like, we'd like to get along with Russia, but they just do these horrible things every once in a while. So anyway, back to Austin's comment. I think it was something we know. On the other side, Putin looks like he's really spoiling for a fight with NATO. You know, he had to clean the Nazis and NATO out of Ukraine. And so on both sides, you have these comments. Clearly, again, with Putin's comments, we know he doesn't like NATO. We know he would like NATO to go away. And that's not going to happen either. So I'm not upset about Austin's comment. And I don't see any reason why anyone else should be.
Right. I mean, and there's a way in which this is perverse, but it actually does make some sense, right? A weaker Russia matters. In a weaker Russia is an alternative to regime change, right? And it's a good alternative to regime change, right? We know that we can't or we should not contemplate, because the costs are too high, to change the regime in Russia. And so, you know, a good half step is like, well, let's reduce the threat that Russia poses then.
Yeah.
And the way we do that is we largely destroy the Russian military. The other outcome of this, which is, you know, still looking likely, sort of almost more likely day by day, is Finnish and Swedish accession into NATO. And I don't know if there's enough discussion about how dramatically this sort of impacts the way that Russia conceives of its security in the North. Right, it essentially cuts off the Baltic. It creates a giant, a really long, poorly defended border that the Russians have to deal with. It threatens other Russian assets in the Arctic. And Finland is a country that's about to have 72 F-35s, right? And right now, it looks like 72 F-35s could do for the entire Russian Air Force all on their own. And, you know, this is not a good thing for Russian security in the way that Putin seems to think about it. It's no matter what's happening here, Russia is going to be weaker and it's going to have more enemies. And, you know, I think we should be fine being forthright about, you know, that reducing the threat that Russia can propose to its neighbors is part of the goal of American foreign policy here.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm fine with that. Your point about Finland and Sweden joining NATO is a good one and something I haven't seen people really comment on and appreciate enough is that that's going to mean NATO owns the Baltic Sea and can cut off easily the access to St. Petersburg and the naval bases in the Gulf of Finland. I mean, it's like 65 kilometers, I think, from Tallinn to Helsinki, and that's a choke point. There's another choke point between Silmäe and, I can't remember the name of the place on the Finnish coast, but that's, they tried to put in a ferry there. There's a couple of Russian islands in the middle of it, and the Russians got kind of picky. It's a little close to the Russian border, but bye-bye St. Petersburg as a military port when Sweden and Finland join NATO. That poorly defended border is forests and swamps, and a colleague said that a Finnish colleague said to him, you can't see the lakes because of the trees. And it's just, as Russia found out in the Winter War, it's a bad place to have a war. And the only time you really can have a war is in the winter when everything's frozen up. So yeah, I don't know why Putin did this. I'm a little bit pleased myself for my predictions, because when I did my counterfactual on if NATO hadn't expanded, Sweden kind of took the lead in building a military alliance against Russia. And of course, Sweden and Russia have fought wars. There was the Great Northern War. And there's no reason ever for Russia to think that Sweden is a friend. And now it's quite explicit.
Right. And you know, of course, both Sweden and Finland have already been cooperative with NATO, right? So it's not as if they're sort of really turning over a new leaf. But, you know, we could now be thinking about U.S. spy aircraft using Finnish airspace in the same ways that they've been using Polish airspace. And, you know, just sort of to magnify the degree to which the NATO alliance and the United States have surveillance and have eyes on everything that's happening of any sort of import with Russia. And this is also a space where it brings, and this is, I mean, this is a really almost an existential concern for Russia, is that it brings NATO much closer to the Russian naval nuclear deterrent. Right.
Right.
Where they, you know, Finnish territory is not very far. Of course, Norway is there, too. But, right. You know, it gives us a lot more access to the points at which they are where they operate their ballistic missile submarines. And that is an existential concern for them in a way that even kind of Ukraine isn't. So, I mean, I am still, this is another one of my escalation concerns. I'm still waiting to see if there's another shoe that's going to drop. I mean, the Russians have played this on Finland and Sweden so badly thus far that, you know, they can't pretend to be nice about it now. Right. But are they going to try to be even more threatening as we move towards, more official steps that Finland and Sweden need to take in order to join. So, and that's kind of scary.
Yeah. The threats, I'm kind of surprised in a way we haven't seen more, although with so much of the Russian military engaged in Ukraine and doing badly, it seems kind of silly for them to open up another front or even threaten to open up another front on, say, Finland. Now, they are trying to look brave and open up another front on Moldova, which Moldova is just a really small place, and it's not that different from Ukraine in terms of military action. It is a separate country. Russia already has sawed a piece of that off with occupying Transnistria. But, you know, when your brave opening up of a second front is on Moldova, again, this is not very impressive. So, good point. Not only the Baltic Sea and the Gulf of Finland, but also the northern areas, which Norway does wrap around there, but having full ability for NATO surveillance planes to fly over Sweden and Finland as well means that we can surveil their submarine bases in Murmansk and Severomorsk. And that is their nuclear submarine fleet. So that is another problem. And again, it's a problem I haven't seen much mentioned either by commentators on either side of things.
I mean, I am curious now whether we are going to, I mean, we haven't seen this that much thus far. I've read a couple things which are trying, sort of from a restrainer point of view, which is, you know, a whole other podcast, by the way. But from a restrainer point of view, are sort of trying to fire up, like, look, we really should slow down on this Finland-Sweden thing. I'm curious whether that conversation is actually going to break out, because it seems like not a lot of people really want to take the ante position on that at this point. It is interesting, right? I mean, I listened to the Ryan Evans and Michael Kaufman podcast this morning, which, by the way, everybody should listen to because it's awesome. I have my problems with Ryan. He knows the problems I have with him, and so it's a complicated thing. But
I have had problems with Ryan too.
One thing that Michael said was that, look, this sounds like a terrible. He was talking about the Moldova situation, and he said, look, this sounds like a terrible idea, but how many things has Russia done over the past 3 months that sound like terrible ideas?
Yeah, really?
No, you can't put it by somebody to in the Kremlin to say, look, here's how we stop Finland from joining NATO. We declare war, right? And they can't bring in a country that's actively at war into NATO, right? That sounds like that's a galaxy brain idea that you expect somebody in Russia to have, right? Maybe hopefully not somebody important, but somebody in Russia to have. So.
Yeah, actually, some of those objections are probably not as strong as they may seem. I've seen people objecting that Russia could start up some kind of boundary dispute with Finland, but Estonia was admitted to NATO when its boundaries were still under dispute with Russia, and Russia was clearly keeping things going with regard to boundaries because they didn't want Estonia to join NATO, but NATO said, yeah, we know what you're doing, Russia. Estonia's in.
So to finish up here, let's pivot to this question of, I know you talked a little bit about it yesterday, and I know you've thought about it, and I'm just sort of trying to formulate my own thoughts about it. What does arms control between the United States, strategic level arms control between Russia and the United States look like after the Ukraine war, right? What can be done here in terms of, you know, the sort of cooperation that we kind of started taking for granted from the late 1970s on? But is sometimes we are to a degree now where the relations between the United States and Russia are worse than the relations between the United States and the Soviet Union at just about any time in the history of the Cold War. So how do you do arms control in that kind of context?
Well, we're almost going to have to start from scratch on arms control again. Arms control was coming apart long before February 24th. You could argue it started with George Bush's withdrawal from the ABM treaty, and that certainly was a turning point. Russia really felt we needed the ABM treaty, and I'm not sure they were entirely wrong.
Oh, no, I think they were right.
It was a real stabilizer, and short-range missiles are pretty scary, and not having that much time to respond leads to bad decisions. So that was a bad decision, and it really started the crumbling of a lot of arms control agreements. And then, of course, Trump tore up a bunch of other things. And, you know, the argument against these things always is, we need more freedom on our side to dream up new weapon systems that we can terrify Russia with, because that will certainly put Russia in its place and keep them there. A little bit of the same thinking of weakening Russia, although from a more assertive point of view. But people forget, if we get a new Russia weapon system, guess what? Russia is going to want a new weapon system too.
And we can't out crazy the Russians. I mean, you know, you cannot on nuclear weapons out crazy the Russians, right? They are making like a nuclear cruise missile, right? Not one with a nuclear warhead, one with a nuclear propulsion system, right? That's insane. Right. A nuclear torpedo that will take days to get to its target. That's also insane. You're not going to be able to come up with some cool weapon that the Russians are not going to come back with something even more crazy.
That's a great point. My feeling all along about those weapons systems that Putin unveiled so proudly with his animations of them has been that there was somebody in Russia like Ed Teller who could really tell a great story about this wonderful new weapon system. And Putin, of course, would be up for a wonderful new weapon system that would outdo the Americans. And, you know, I think it was like Ed Teller and Star Wars. I have not yet identified who the Russian Ed Teller is, but I think somebody came up with a crazy idea. And, you know, Teller really wanted to do the experiments, and he really wanted to fool around with the stuff. So I think his Russian equivalent really wanted to see if they could make a cruise missile with a nuclear propulsion system. Yay! Oh, boy. And it looks like they really did do some experiments to try to make the thing work. But the thing is, like you say, those are just crazy. They, you know, just building them, operating them, maintaining them. We tried to build a nuclear-operated cruise missile in the 1960s, 1970s, and it was relatively successful for what it was, but it was just a nightmare. Nobody wants that kind of thing in a war zone. And, you can't out crazy the Russians on these systems. So arms control. So how do we do arms control? Well, maybe Russia would give up those systems and they could be negotiated against. I think that would be a good move for Russia. But we can't even talk to Russia right now. I frankly don't know where you start. I did have a discussion the other day with a few people who were talking about arms control ideas that would require counting every nuclear weapon, somehow tagging each one, taking down its serial number, whatever, and looking at each weapon. That's a really difficult problem. The way we count weapons now in the New START treaty, which is about all that's left, is we say, well, each bomber can carry so many weapons, or each missile has so many weapons on it. And we don't look at them in particular. I think there is some sampling done whereby each side opens up the nose cone of a missile and says, look, we've only got three in here, or whatever the number is supposed to be. But it certainly isn't done for every nuclear weapon on every missile. And that was kind of the next step we had gotten to in arms control, if everything had proceeded well in arms control. There's a lot of ideas for how to do that. But I was involved in something somewhat similar during the 1990s. And I will say that even the United States is not and certainly now it's worse, is not going to just say, okay, guys, you can come in and check all those serial numbers on all our nuclear weapons. That's not going to happen for some time. So the political issues are enormous. And we barely have any contact with the Russians at this point among the people who would be doing that sort of thing.
Right. And you know, and sort of ironically or sort of absurdly, a lot of what's happening right now plays into the way that the Trump administration wanted to talk about arms control, which was always, we have to involve the Chinese, we have to involve the Chinese. But we're now projecting a future in which, you know, the Chinese arsenal is rapidly increasing. And so when we can actually sit down and have a conversation 5 or 6 or 7 years from now, who knows when, you probably do have to include the Chinese, right? Because it's no longer a situation where they have this tiny arsenal that can't be regulated. So just to finish up, is there anything you're going to be paying close attention to over the next week? I don't know when we're going to do our next pod. It might be a week away, but is there anything in particular you're going to be looking at this next week?
Well, I hope to be writing more on the Biden information offensive. I think there's been not enough attention paid to that, although there was a good article in Washington Post about a week ago, because it's a whole different way to think about doing war. And that ties in with some other things I'm doing behind the scenes, which will show up in the fall. And, you know, just watching what's happening, things are a little slow in the war right now. Like you said, Russia is bombarding with artillery and then making some really small gains. There's going to be more equipment coming in to Ukraine. I suspect things might calm down a little bit on the is Russia going to use nukes side of things, because that's something that kind of goes up and down with media interest. But for the most part, man, I can't, in a long-term serious point of view, I can't figure out what the Russians are doing.
Yeah, one of the things I'm going to be paying attention to is what the Ukrainians are going to do on the southern front near Kherson. I think one way to read the Transnistria move is the Russians recognizing that they cannot plausibly threaten Odessa with an amphibious assault. And yet they need to tie down the forces that the Ukrainians are still garrisoning Odessa with. Because, you know, if the Ukrainians throw those into the fight, it really sort of changes the equation about what's going on near Kherson sort of on the approaches to Mykolaiv. And I think that's going to be something that's going to be interesting to watch this next week. My guess is that the Donbass is going to look like the Donbass 7 days from now, but it's hard to say.
Yeah.
All right. Well, unless you have anything else, I think we can wrap this one.
Okay.
Well, I want to thank everyone for listening. Cheryl, I want to thank you. We are coming up on LGM's birthday. So if you have any sweet Patreon donations you want to send our way, the links are all over the website. So Cheryl, thank you for joining us.
Okay. Thank you, Rob.
Thank you again for listening to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. We would like to thank Elizabeth Nelson of The Paranoid Style for supplying the music necessary to make this podcast possible. You can find this track and the rest of The Paranoid Style's catalog anywhere you can find quality music. If you would like to support the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast or any other aspect of the Lawyers, Guns, and Money project, please visit us at www.patreon.com/lawyersgunsandmoney or donate through the PayPal link on the main website. Thank you again,